Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. And here are your business headlines for today. Max streaming service builds momentum by dropping more is better approach. Boeing narrows loss as backlog grows, shares rise. AT&T posts higher profit, revenue after adding more fiber, 5G customers. Philip Morris lifts outlook as Zin popularity holds strong. Volvo cuts North American truck market forecast as tariff uncertainty mounts. GE Vernova swings to profit as backlog rises. Jury finds New York Times didn't defame Sarah Palin. Top 60 Minutes executive quits, citing editorial pressure. Three factories, $355,000, and the maddening quest to make a clear can. Hollywood super networker is building an entertainment powerhouse. New streaming on Netflix, a show where profits trump the trade war. General Dynamics IQ profit jumps on rising revenue. The first article I'll read today is Max Streaming Service builds momentum by dropping more is better approach. Warner pivots to pared-down model instead of competing with Netflix and forecasts 150 million subscribers in 2026, by Joe Flint. A group of Warner Brothers Discovery executives gathered in a conference room at the Beverly Hills Hotels last spring to discuss a hard truth. Their Max streaming service was kind of a letdown. It wasn't considered a must-have or utility service like Netflix and Amazon Prime, but more of an add-on item, a strategy officer told the team, including Chief Executive David Zaslav and Casey Bloys, who runs the content for HBO and Max. Over snacks, coffee, and Diet Cokes, they plotted Max's revival. "We said, okay, we've got to sort of refocus our bullseye," said J.P. Perrette, CEO and president of Global Streaming. Warner has spent the past year picking apart and rebuilding Max, turning it into one of the company's relative bright spots. The entertainment giant, born out of 2022's merger between AT&T's Warner Media and Discovery Communications, has struggled to convince investors it is on the right track. The company's stock is down about two-thirds since the deal. Its movie studio suffered a string of flops before a Minecraft movie and Sinners hit it big, and its cable networks are in structural decline. Building momentum at Max is a crucial part of the company's pitch to investors. Max added 20 million subscribers in 2024 to finish the year at 117 million globally and expects to hit 150 million in 2026. Netflix, by comparison, ended last year with more than 300 million subscribers. The platform still has a relatively small share of U.S. TV time, about 1.5%, according to figures from Nielsen. That's less than Peacock and Paramount, though Warner executives say Nielsen's data doesn't capture viewing via Amazon channels. Max increased its adjusted earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization to $677 million last year from $103 million a year earlier. It forecast EBIT data of $1.3 billion for the current year. When Zaslav unveiled plans for the Max streaming service 2 years ago, he declared, "This is our rendezvous with destiny." That destiny, as he laid it out at the time, was to be the place every member of the household can go to. It offered critically acclaimed fare from HBO, popular reality shows from Discovery's cable networks, and lots of children's programmings. But most consumers already had a streaming service for every member of the household. It was called Netflix. From late 2022 until the end of 2023, Max's subscriber numbers hovered between 95 million and 100 million. What people want from us is a world where they've got Netflix and Amazon. Are those things that differentiate us? Bloy said. After the Beverly Hills meeting, Max dropped its focus on children's programming, acknowledging it couldn't break through with young viewers already glued to Netflix and Disney. Even sacred cows such as Sesame Street and the Looney Tunes content library were cut loose. A lot of Discovery's unscripted shows from channels such as Food Network and HGTV also weren't moving the needle for Max. There's less of that on the platform now. And while live sports were initially available on the lower-priced ad-supported version of Max, now only those with the premium subscription tier can get baseball, basketball, and other sports. Max's Second Life is more streamlined, with adult-oriented content like The Pit and Hacks, and true crime offerings such as the documentary Quiet and Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, and HBO's highly anticipated Harry Potter series is scheduled to debut in 2026. We're not fighting for the more is better game, Perriott said. We'll let others deal with the volume. One key part of Max's makeover was a bundling partnership. It launched with Disney last summer, which subscribers can purchase Max, Disney Plus, and Hulu at a significant discount to their respective standalone prices. It's been a major subscriber driver, with high retention rates, and Warner executives have said they're eager to extend the partnership overseas. Still, some investors want more wholesale programs of progress from Warner. Late last week, the company restructured into two operating divisions, one housing the legacy cable business and the other comprising the streaming operation and movie and TV production studios. The move was seen as a potential precursor to a spin-off or sale of the cable business. Warner added directors with digital and technology chops after encouragement from activist Sessa Capital. Should a split or spin-off happen, Max would be expected to serve as the revenue-generating warhorse for the company, said Guggenheim securities analyst Michael Morris. Write to Joe Flint at joe.flint@wsj.com. Boeing narrows loss as backlog grows, shares rise. Chief Executive Kelly Ortberg said the company is closely watching trade developments and expects the company's backlog to provide some flexibility. By Catherine Hamilton. Boeing reported a narrower first quarter loss as CEO Kelly Ortberg said the company's higher backlog has provided some flexibility amid the trade war. The airplane maker's backlog grew to $545 billion in the first quarter, including 5,600 commercial planes. Boeing shares were up 5.5% to $171.45 per share in pre-market trading. The airplane maker on Wednesday posted a loss of $31 million, or 16 cents a share, in the 3 months ended March 31st, compared with a loss of $355 million, or 56 cents a share, a year earlier. Stripping out certain one-time items, adjusted per share loss was 49 cents, narrower than the $1.18 loss forecasted by analysts, according to FactSet. Revenue rose 18% to $19.5 billion. Analysts surveyed by FactSet forecast revenue of $19.38 billion. The results reflected only tariffs enacted as of March 31st, Boeing said. While we're closely watching the developments in global trade, our strong start to the year, combined with the demand for airplanes and our $500 billion backlog for our products and services, gives us the flexibility we need to navigate this environment, Ortberg said. In the wake of the new tariffs, China told its airlines last week not to place new orders with Boeing and to seek approval before taking delivery of aircraft they already ordered. U.S. airlines are cutting capacity as travel demand slows, which could further drag down new plane orders from Boeing, analysts say. Revenue from Boeing's commercial airline business increased 75% to $8.15 billion in the first quarter, and production of Boeing's 737 planes gradually increased in the first quarter and is still expected to reach 38 per month this year. Boeing plans to ask the Federal Aviation Administration if it can increase production to 42 planes a month, once key performance indicators show a stable production system, Warburg said. Its defense, space, and security segment had revenue fall 9% to $6.3 billion in the quarter. Its contract with Air Force to design and build the F-47 fighter jet was not included in the backlog at the end of the quarter. The Arlington, Virginia company is trying to slash costs and refocus on its core business. It said on Tuesday it was selling some of its digital aviation solutions in a deal worth $10.55 billion. Ortberg said in a letter to employees, the deal would help strengthen Boeing's financial position by streamlining business operations. Write to Catherine Hamilton at catherine.hamilton@wsj.com. AT&T posts higher profit revenue after adding more fiber and 5G customers. The company backs its 2025 guidance. By Denny Jacob and Connor Hart. AT&T logged higher profit and revenue in the first quarter, boosted by an increase in acquired customers. Shares rose 3.6% in pre-market trading to $27.95. The stock is up about 18% on the year so far. The telecommunications company on Wednesday posted net income attributable to the common stock of $4.4 billion, or 61 cents a share, compared with $3.4 billion, or 47 cents a share, a year earlier. Adjusted pre-share earnings came in at 51 cents, in line with the expectations of analysts polled by FactSet. Revenue ticked up 2% to $30.6 billion, ahead of the $30.36 billion the analysts modeled. The Dallas company notched 324,000 postpaid phone net adds during the quarter, in addition to 261,000 AT&T fiber net adds. AT&T said it plans to commence a share repurchase in the current quarter, adding that it is operating within its net leverage target of net debt to adjusted EBITDA, or earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, based on its reduction in net debt and outlook. The company backed its 2025 guidance, which calls for adjusted per-share earnings of $1.97 to $2.07, slightly lower than analysts' views for $2.08, according to FactSet. AT&T also expects consolidated service revenue growth in the low single-digit range and adjusted EBITDA growth of at least 3%. Our business fundamentals remain strong, and we're uniquely positioned to win in this dynamic and competitive market, Chief Executive John Stankley said. AT&T's results stand in contrast to those of competitor Verizon Communications on Tuesday. Verizon lost 289,000 wireless postpaid phone business consumer subscribers, worse than the 114,000 postpaid phone net loss in the year ago period. Write to Denny Jacob at denny.jacob@wsj.com and Connor Hart at connor.hart@wsj.com. Volvo cuts North American truck market forecast as tariff uncertainty mounts. Trucks sold fell 9%, though order to intake grew 13%, driven by European demand, by Pierre Bertrand. Truck maker Volvo cut its forecast for North America's truck market amid increasing uncertainty about U.S. tariffs and regulatory changes, as it reported a decline in deliveries for the first quarter. U.S. customers are adopting a wait-and-see approach due to uncertainty surrounding tariffs and emissions rules, Volvo said Wednesday. The Swedish company now expects 25,000 fewer truck registrations, a proxy for sales in North America this year than previously forecast, as increased market uncertainty weighs on customer sentiment. Customers in the construction and oil and gas sectors are increasingly hesitant, Volvo Chief Executive Martin Lundstedt said at a press conference. The company produced more trucks for North America than the market could absorb, and it plans to adjust production levels to minimize this growing forward, he said. In addition to uncertainty about truck tariffs, truck makers are grappling with an overhaul of U.S. environmental policies after the Environmental Protection Agency said it would reconsider Biden-era emissions regulations designed to reduce truck air pollutants. Volvo no longer expects customers pre-buying trucks this year as a result, he said. In the first quarter, Volvo's North American deliveries declined 5%, though orders grew 6% and retail sales dropped 13%, it said. By comparison, European orders rose 25%, deliveries declined 18%, and registrations fell 15%. For the group as a whole, first quarter vehicle sales increased by 9%, deliveries fell 12%, while orders rose 13%. Demand for buses, by contrast, remained strong, with the business segment posting an increase in orders and net sales. Volvo said net profit in the quarter was 9.89 billion kroner, or $1.3 billion, compared with 14.08 kroner a year earlier. Sales declined 7% to 121.8 billion kroner. Analysts had expected the company to post net profit of 11.62 billion kroner in the first quarter on sales of 128.56 billion kroner, according to Visible Alpha Consensus. The company also lowered its 2025 forecast for Brazilian truck registrations, but maintained its forecast for the year for Europe, where it expects increases in defense spending to gradually drive demand from armed forces. Right to Pierre Bertrand, it's Pierre.Bertrand at WSJ.com. Dow headed for worst April since 1932, as investors send no confidence signal. Few think administration's negotiations with trade partners will yield results soon enough to ease the strain. By Hannah Aaron Lang. The Trump rout is taking on historic dimensions. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed almost 1,000 points on Monday and is headed for its worst April performance since 1932, according to Dow Jones market data. The S&P 500's performance since Inauguration Day is now the worst for any president up to this point in data going back to 1928, according to Bespoke Investment Group. Worries about trade restrictions and the prospect of President Trump firing Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell have investors bracing for greater losses ahead. Corporate earnings reports are rolling in, along with executives' tariff-dented outlooks for the months ahead. Few think the administration's negotiations with trade partners will yield results soon enough to ease the strain. Meanwhile, counterweights that usually strengthen when stocks fall, such as government bonds and the U.S. dollar, are also under pressure, leaving investors with few havens to wait out the storm. It's the hallmark of the no-confidence trade, said Scott Ladner, Chief Investment Officer at Horizon Investments. The Charlotte-based firm trimmed its U.S. equity positions several weeks ago to favor more international stocks. It's impossible to commit capital to an economy that is unstable and unknowable because of policy structure. In the weeks after Donald Trump's president's victory, Major U.S. stock indexes soared, lifted by investors' hopes for tax cuts and a deregulatory push that could boost corporate earnings. But the administration instead pressed ahead with aggressive tariffs that threatened to raise prices and slow economic growth. Many investors still wrote off the president's threats as mere bluster, a negotiating tactic meant to spur concessions from other countries. That changed on April 2nd, when Trump revealed steep tariffs that sent markets into a tailspin. Markets still haven't recovered, even after the president rolled back and delayed many of his tariff plans. Typically, bond prices rise when stocks fall, offering a hedge for investors during this stock market turmoil. But that hasn't been the case in recent weeks. Yields on 10-year U.S. Treasuries, a key benchmark for borrowing costs, have increased to 0.16 percentage point in April. Bond yields rise as prices fall, meaning investors are selling U.S. government bonds, widely considered one of the safest and most dependable assets, even when stocks are falling. Concerns about the economy, along with fears about Trump's growing feud with the Fed, are weighing on the U.S. dollar. The ICE U.S. dollar index, a measure for the dollar against a basket of major currencies, slipped more than 1% on Monday to its lowest level in 3 years. With other defense plays falling short, investors have piled into one of the oldest hedges there is, gold. Future prices for the precious metal reached another all-time high on Monday. The market's fear gauge remains elevated, with worries about the trade war and the broader economy adding up to expectations for more volatility ahead. The mood on Wall Street is darkening as a result. Bearishness levels, or expectations that stocks prices will fall, among ordinary investors have hovered above 50% for 8 consecutive weeks, according to a weekly survey from American Association of Individual Investors. That is the longest-lasting bear majority on record, the investor group said, based on data going back to 1987. Write to Hannah Aaron Lang at hannaherrin.lang. That's hannaherrin.lang at wsj.com. Jury finds New York Times didn't defame Sarah Palin. The verdict comes in the second trial of 2017 lawsuit by Corian Ramey and Isabella Simonetti. A federal jury in New York City rejected former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin's claims that the New York Times defamed her in an editorial about gun violence. The verdict, if not libel, which was returned Tuesday after about 2 hours of deliberation, was the same conclusion a previous jury had reached in 2022 during the first trial in the case. The second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals last year ordered a new trial, finding that the judge acted improperly when he said during jury deliberations that he planned to dismiss the case. Palin, a former Republican vice presidential candidate, sued the Times and its former opinion editor, James Bennett, in 2017. She argued that a Times editorial that year wrongly suggested that an ad circulated by her political action committee inspired a 2011 shooting in Tucson, Arizona, where 6 people died, and then Representative Gabby Giffords, a Democrat, was wounded. The link to political incitement was clear, said the original version of the editorial. The Times quickly corrected the article online, in print, and on social media. "We want to thank the jurors for their careful deliberations," a Times spokeswoman said. "The decision reaffirms an important tenet of American law. Publishers are not liable for honest mistakes." Palin could appeal the verdict. A lawyer for Palin didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Since the first trial, trust in mainstream media outlets has continued to erode, and many top news organizations have faced defamation lawsuits. The verdict shows that even against the new backdrop, jurors are willing to rule in favor of major media outlets, lawyers said. It reaffirms the centrality of the New York Times versus Sullivan case to press freedom in our country, said Floyd Abrams, a veteran First Amendment lawyer, referring to a Supreme Court decision that set a high bar for public officials to sue news outlets for defamation. Abrams represented the Times in litigation over publication of the Pentagon Papers, a secret Defense Department review of the Vietnam War in 1971. In court, a lawyer for Palin, Ken Terkel, told jurors that evidence showed that the Times either knew its statement about the former governor was false or had acted with reckless disregard for the truth. He said that the paper's opinion editors had a theory about the politicization of gun violence, then went in search of an example. Bennett was so fixated on his politicization theory that he lost sight of reality, Terkel said. They hold on to it so much that the truth becomes a tragedy, he said during closing arguments. Terkel said that while the paper had issued corrections, Palin's name today remains in the online version of the article. It's because she doesn't matter, he added. She's just a casualty of their theories, of their narratives. A lawyer for the Times, Felicia Ellsworth, told jurors that for Palin to win the case, they must find that Bennett and the Times didn't care about the truth when drafting and revising the editorial. She said that Times editors didn't think the editorial would be read to say that a Palin PAC ad featuring a map with crosshairs to identify congressional districts with Democratic incumbents was the cause of the shooting, but an example of political rhetoric. Bennett's efforts around correcting the article also show he and others at the paper took errors seriously, she added. There has not been one shred of evidence showing anything other than an honest mistake, added Ellsworth. She said that Palin's reputation wasn't dented by the editorial, as shown by her appearance on television and President Trump's support of her congressional campaign in Alaska. For Governor Palin, this case is just another opportunity to take on fake news, Ellsworth added. But for Bennett, she said, the case was about the truth. Media companies have faced a number of high-profile defamation lawsuits in recent years. Earlier this year, Warner Brothers Discovery, CNN, settled a lawsuit after a Florida jury found the network liable for defaming a U.S. Navy veteran. In December, ABC News agreed to contribute $15 million to Trump's Presidential Foundation, or museum, to settle his defamation lawsuit against the network and news anchor George Stephanopoulos. Fox, in 2023, agreed to pay $787.5 million to settle a defamation suit brought by Dominion Voting Systems over false claims that the voting machine company helped rig the U.S. 2020 presidential election. Fox News parent, Fox Corp., and Wall Street Journal parent, News Corp., share common ownership. Write to Corianne Ramey at corianne.ramey@ws.com and Isabella Simonetti at isabella.simonetti@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Top 60 Minutes executive quits, citing editorial pressure. Bill Owens leaves CBS News show that has been a major target of President Trump, by Joe Flint and Jessica Tunkel. The top executive at CBS news program 60 Minutes resigned Tuesday, saying he had lost editorial independence, a high-profile departure from company in the throes of a legal battle with President Trump. Bill Owens, executive producer of 60 Minutes, said in a memo to staff that it had become clear he would not be able to run the show as I have always run it. Owens has faced criticism from Sherry Redstone, whose family company controls CBS parent Paramount Global, for his editorial decisions, including coverage choices regarding the Israel-Hamas war from Trump over an October interview with Kamala Harris. Trump sued CBS News over how 60 Minutes edited the Harris interview, alleging that the network committed election interference by favorably editing portions and giving her an edge in her campaign for president. The network has said it was neither doctored nor deceitful. In February, Truth amended the suit to seek $20 billion in damages, up from $10 billion when he filed it in the fall. Paramount Global is pursuing a merger with Skydance Media and needs approval from the Federal Communications Commission to cross the finish line. The FCC has opened an investigation into possible news distortion by CBS News in relation to its editing of the Harris interview. Redstone, the non-executive chair of Paramount, has advocated for a settlement with Trump, hoping it will clear the way for merger approval. A mediator was recently tapped to try to bring the parties together on a deal, and mediation is expected to begin at the end of the month, according to people familiar with the situation. Inside CBS News, some are reluctant to settle, particularly if such a settlement includes any sort of apology, people familiar with the division's thinking have said. Some of Paramount's top executives and directors are concerned they could be exposed to criminal charges if a settlement is viewed as bribing a public official to get the deed approved, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Executives at Skydance have also pushed Paramount for a settlement, according to people familiar with the situation. Ed Patzlik, a lawyer for Trump, said the president will pursue this vital matter to just and rightful conclusion. Trump's lawsuit and the regulatory review of Paramount's merger with Skydance are proceeding on different tracks. SEC Chairman Brendan Carr has said the third-party news distortion complaint about the way 60 Minutes edited the Harris interview could factor into the agency's review of the merger. In the meeting with staff Tuesday, Owens said he had become a problem for CBS, according to a person who attended the gathering. The New York Times earlier reported on Owens' resignation. Trump has continued to criticize 60 Minutes in recent months. They're not a news show, but a dishonest political operative, simply disguised as news and must be responsible for what they have done or are doing. They should lose their license. Trump posted on his Truth Social platform after an April 13th broadcast that included stories about Greenland and the war in Ukraine. While Owens didn't name Redstone as the primary reason for his departure, people familiar with his thinking said that was who he was referring to in his memo and remarks. Owens wasn't immediately available for comment. Redstone has become an increasingly vocal critic of CBS News and of Owens' stewardship of 60 Minutes. Earlier this year, she criticized a 60-minute story about the Biden administration's handling of the war in Gaza, which drew criticism from Jewish groups and others for having an anti-Israel bias. Owens, who has worked for CBS News since 1988, began overseeing 60 Minutes in 2019. Last August, he also added responsibility for CBS Evening News. Write to Joe Flint at joe.flint@wsj.com and Jessica Tunkel at jessica.tunkel@wsj.com. Why Trump decided not to try to fire Jerome Powell. White House lawyers were studying legal options for ousting the Fed chair, but senior advisors warned Trump that attempting to do so would rattle markets. By Brian Schwartz, Josh Dowsey, and Nick Timmeros. Washington. President Trump said this week that he never had any plans to fire Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, accusing the media of pushing a false narrative that he was out to get the central bank chief. But inside the White House, some senior officials took Trump's recent public musings about terminating Powell seriously. As Trump's criticism of the Fed chair ramped up the last week, White House lawyers privately reviewed legal options for attempting to remove Powell, including whether they could do so for a cause, according to people familiar with the matter. The laws that created the Federal Reserve say Fed governors can only be removed before their term ends for cause, which courts have generally interpreted to mean malfeasance or impropriety. Finding a pretext for dismissing Powell would have edged the White House closer to a dramatic escalation with the central bank. Those discussions came to a halt early this week when Trump told his senior aides that he wouldn't try to oust Powell. His decision came after interventions from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, who warned Trump that such a move could trigger far-reaching market chaos and a messy legal fight, the people said. Lutnick also told the president that efforts to fire the federal chair likely wouldn't lead to any practical change on interest rates because other members of the Fed's board would likely approach monetary policy similarly to Powell, one of the people said. On Tuesday afternoon, Trump put the matter to rest for now. He told reporters gathered at the Oval Office that he has no intention of firing Powell, softening the sharp rhetoric that he had repeated just one day before. This is a perfect time to lower interest rates. If he doesn't, is it the end? No, it's not, Trump said. The president has a terrific team of advisors that give him counsel on numerous topics, but at the end of the day, the president is the final decision maker, White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers said, declining to comment on Trump's private conversations. Treasury Department and Commerce Department spokespeople didn't respond to requests for comment. Trump came into office promising a blunt and potentially painful rewiring of the global economy. But as markets have revolted against his aggressive trade and economic moves, the president has responded with climb downs and accommodations. In addition to backing off his market-rattling threats to oust Powell, Trump on Tuesday signaled a new willingness to lower steep tariffs on China. The twin walkbacks came after he paused many of his proposed tariffs for 90 days. Trump's comments this week reassured jittery investors who were panicking about the president's aggressive rhetoric. And they showed that despite the president's insistence that he isn't fazed by the ups and downs of the market, he and his advisors are paying close attention to how Wall Street and major corporations respond to his agenda. Trump continues to track the markets closely, a senior administration official said. On Monday, Trump met with the White House with senior executives from the country's biggest retailers, including Target, Walmart, and Home Depot. They told the president that his tariffs, particularly the duties he placed on China, could raise prices for consumers. A person familiar with the conversation said. A day later, Trump told reporters that the 145% tariffs on Chinese imports were very high and would come down substantially. Administration officials are discussing how much lower the tariffs should be, according to people familiar with the matter. Tesla CEO Elon Musk, a senior Trump advisor who leads the Department of Government Efficiency, said during an earnings call on Tuesday that he would advocate for lowering tariffs in his conversations with the president. Whether he will listen to my advice is up to him, said Musk. The billionaire said that would devote less time to his work with Doge amid sliding at Tesla, which took a reputational hit from Musk's association with the administration. Most Wall Street analysts believe attempting to remove Powell before his term ends wouldn't get the president the lowered rates that he wants because there's no support on the central bank's 12-person rate setting committee to reduce interest rates right now. The Fed cut rates by 1 percentage point last year because inflation had declined and they didn't want to risk an unnecessary recession. Tariffs have frozen up Fed officials because they worry they will push up prices and introduce new risks of higher inflation, even if they later chill spending and hiring that weakens the economy. One illustration of the challenge the president faces in getting the Fed to lower rates is Trump last month elevated a Fed governor that he appointed during his first term, Michael Bauman, to serve as the vice chair for bank supervision. Bauman has been one of the most outspoken officials to warn against the risks of lowering interest rates too soon or too fast. The Fed's operational autonomy, or its independence, has long been viewed as sacrosanct by bond investors on Wall Street. Some foreign investors could be less likely to buy U.S. Treasury securities, leading to higher interest rates if they feared that the American government would tolerate higher levels of inflation by telling the central bank how to set interest rates. The market reaction to successfully forcing out the Fed chair would be apocalyptic, said Tim Mahidi, chief economist at Access Macro, who was a senior advisor at the San Francisco Fed, in a note to clients last week. He predicted that pain would be so swift and severe that the president would be forced to walk it back immediately or face a systemic financial event. Powell has consistently said he doesn't believe the Fed's independence will be compromised. That arrangement is very widely understood and supported in Washington. In Congress, where it really matters, he said during a talk in Chicago last week. While Trump regularly made similar threats against the Fed in 2019, investors viewed the recent squabble as different for two reasons. First, Trump has been far more willing to defy institutional and legal norms than in his first term. The Justice Department is seeking to overturn a 90-year legal precedent that many legal experts believe provides the strongest guardrail against removing Fed officials from office before their terms expire. Second, inflation could be a bigger problem this year because Trump's tariffs are much larger and broader than those he imposed on his first term. That is threatening a more difficult trade-off for the Fed, which in recent years lifted interest rates to a two-decade high to fight inflation. Powell has viewed the unsavory prospect of a legal showdown, one he might have to pay for out of his own pocket, as imperative to preserve the ability of future Fed chairs to serve without the threat of being removed over a policy dispute. The Fed has guarded its independence to set monetary policy ever since the very high inflation of the 1970s. President Richard Nixon privately pressured his Fed chairman and former advisor, Arthur Burns, to ease policy ahead of the 1972 election, according to Oval Office recordings. Years of high inflation were cured by a punishing recession in the early 1980s. While the Fed's independence wasn't enshrined in law after that, the experience led to a broader institutional understanding by presidents, Congress, and the Fed that the central bank should be granted a reasonable amount of deference to achieve the goals of keeping inflation low with a healthy labor market. Many other central banks in the 1990s sought and were granted considerable operational autonomy or independence by their governments to set interest rates with an eye towards the long-run good of the economy. Write to Brian Schwartz at brian.schwartz@wsj.com, Josh Dowsey at joshua.dowsey@wsj.com, and Nick Timiraos at nicktimiraos@wsj.com. Tesla has a deep hole to pull out of. Elon Musk promises more attention on EV maker, but brand damage from his political activities won't be easy to repair. By Dan Gallagher. Tesla's famously busy boss will be devoting a lot more time to the electric vehicle maker soon. It's unclear whether that will be a good thing. Elon Musk said on Tesla's first quarter earnings call on Tuesday that he would be allocating more time to Tesla starting next month. Now that the major work of establishing the Department of Government Efficiency is done, the comments come after the company reported one of its worst quarters in recent memory, with revenue seeing its biggest year-over-year slide in 13 years and operating income coming in about 65% below Wall Street's estimates. The timing might seem to suggest that Musk's distracted driving is the main reason for Tesla's woes, But the results actually confirm that Musk's controversial work with the Trump administration has tarnished Tesla's image with many prospective buyers. The company pointed to changing political sentiment as a factor affecting demand in its letter to shareholders Tuesday, and Musk led off the company's earnings call addressing the blowback, in which he blamed protests against the company on recipients of wasteful largesse. He added that he expects to continue spending a day or two each week on government matters. In other words, Tesla's hyper-political CEO won't be getting any less political, even if he spends a little less time in D.C., and that could continue to cast a shadow over the company, which also now has to deal with a trade war that will likely raise its costs in a sharp drop in consumer confidence that could result in fewer people willing to spend up on a new car. Many of these factors weren't even in full swing during the first quarter, and still Tesla's automotive sales revenue plunged 21% from a year earlier to about $12.9 billion in the quarter, 13% lower, even Wall Street's downgraded projections. The company automotive gross margins also took a sharp hit, falling to their lowest level since 2012, at 11.3%. Tesla even seemed to backtrack on its projection from the 3 months ago for annual sales to return to growth this year. We will revisit our 2025 guidance in our Q2 update, the company said in its release. Tesla's share price still managed to perk up, though, rising about 5% in after-hours trading. The stock benefited from Tuesday's big broad market upswing and from the perception that it has been punished enough. By Tuesday's close, Tesla's shares were down nearly 16% since President Trump's tariff announcement earlier this month, and 41% since the first of the year. Only five other S&P 500 stocks have fared worse this year, according to FactSet data. But even a downtrodden Tesla is still expensive, with the stock now fetching 88 times forward earnings compared with the multiple of more than 120 times at the first of the year. That is far in excess of any carmaker and even mega-cap tech stocks such as NVIDIA. Most of Tesla's valuation lies in hopes for the company's efforts in artificial intelligence, self-driving cars, and robotics. Musk said Tuesday that those efforts in autonomy will start contributing in a material way to its businesses around the middle of the next year. But Musk also has a long history of missing his own projections. And now the success of those ventures might also depend on how well he manages his image by then. People who won't buy a car from Musk's company are unlikely to put up one of his robots in their house. Write to Dan Gallagher at dan.gallagher@wsj.com. U.S. rents are slipping, but tariffs could drive them right back up. Amid potential tariffs in construction materials and economic uncertainty keeping potential home buyers out of the sales market, rental demand could soon greatly outweigh supply. By Casey Farmer. U.S. rents have finally stabilized below the 2022 record high, but impending tariffs could bring them right back up again. The country's median asking rent was $1,620 in March, falling 0.6% annually and rising 0.4% from February, according to a report from Redfin on Monday. U.S. rents have remained fairly stable for the past 13 months, seeing a year-to-year change in prices of less than 1% and are now firmly below the peak median price of $1,700 in 2022. But with possible tariffs on building materials on the horizon, amid an already slowed pace of construction, rents are likely to climb again soon. America gets a lot of building materials from other countries, so tariffs will make building apartments more expensive, said Redfin's economics research lead Chen Zhao. Tariffs could also drive up rents by increasing demand. People may opt to rent instead of buy homes because the turmoil around tariffs has fueled widespread economic uncertainty. Tariffs have already caused huge swings in the stock market, and they will lead to higher prices for many goods and services, along with increased unemployment. The mass layoffs across federal departments has already noticeably affected the Washington, D.C. metro area's housing market, as many are listing their homes for sale after losing their jobs. In the report, Redfin Premier agent Matt Ferris shared that he has one client who is considering selling their home and renting a different place for a year because they're concerned about losing their job. A significant annual rent increase of 8.5% shows rental demand is increasing in the nation's capital. Cincinnati reported the largest annual jump in rents at 12.1%, bringing the median asking rent to $1,400. Although the Ohio City has had an influx of new apartments, it isn't keeping up with demand, and many of the new units are in high-priced buildings. Meanwhile, Austin, Texas saw the largest year-over-year decline in rents, which hit $1,420 in March, down 10.7% from last year, and $375 below its record high. Austin became a boomtown during the pandemic, and Texas was one of the top home builders during that time, now contributing to the capital city's rent decreases. And now for some opinion articles. Is Trump a tyrant or a savior? Maybe just a bumbler? The goals of his second term are ambitious, but so far the execution has been strikingly incompetent. By Gerard Baker. If you confine yourself to the mass media, you won't find many dissenters from a binary view of President Trump's second first 100 days. His hyperactive start is either an overdue and necessarily bruising overhaul of America's corrupted institutional framework, a revolution against a failed establishment, or else the most menacing arrogation of executive power in the history of the Republic, a series of giant steps towards complete authoritarian takeover. But I wonder if there isn't an emerging mass of people for whom the bigger question isn't whether their president is a savior or a tyrant, but whether this man and this team are really capable of pulling off a project so bold and ambitious, whatever the intent. The important question may not be whether they are encouragingly redemptive or bottomlessly malevolent, but whether they are simply incapable. To be sure, the grand task they have set for themselves, remaking the American and global order of the past few decades, would have been a stretch for a team of brilliant strongmen with the political genius of Machiavelli and the ruthless efficiency of the Spanish Inquisition. Mr. Trump's immediate principal goals are laudable and commendable, and commanded widespread approval. Close the porous border, downsize a bloated government, end the woke lunacy that has most of our establishment in its thrall, restore American strength in the world. But identifying goals is the easy part. Achieving them is a different matter. This exercise requires successful fights with entrenched, powerful interests in a diverse and pluralistic country and world. In their multi-front 100-day war, the Trump team has taken on, in no particular order, the courts, leading universities, most of the media, much of the legal profession, the bond markets, the currency markets, the equity markets, the world's second largest economy and second most powerful geopolitical force, the global system of alliances, and the global economic system. The theory behind the Blitzkrieg approach is that its boldness is its principal guarantee of success, that by flooding the zone, you keep enemies off balance and disoriented by the sheer energy, demoralized by the sheer ambition. But you do have to execute. The evidence is accumulating that this war is less Blitzkrieg than Blunderland. The Department of Government Efficiency has, as many of us suspected it would, delivered a mouse to challenge the mountain of U.S. government spending. The effort to revive American manufacturing is harming American manufacturing. Changing the rules of the international economy has proved hard. We still await even more of those vaunted trade deals from supplicant foreigners. Ending the war in Ukraine hasn't happened, but we have managed to alienate just about every partner we have. We may at least be edging closer to a bold new Iranian strategy, but it seems to be a retread of Barack Obama's failed strategy. Not only is there no evidence that China has been cowed by any of this, but it also seems the People's Republic of Harvard now likes its chances against the federal government, helped by the report that a blundering administration accidentally pressed send. To give credit where due, immigration restrictionism has been a big success. Many of us will not like the price paid in legal chicanery and a dubiously necessary heavy hand, but the administration may yet have to choose between an outright constitutional crisis and looking weak if it backs down to the courts over its deportation efforts. By the law enforcement efforts and the message sent to immigration, scaffolds have begun to offset the damage done by years of open borders. But elsewhere, the impression is of escalating failure alongside escalating overreach. In its first few weeks, the most striking difference between the second and first Trump administration was a unity of purpose, a lack of internal dissent, and an accent on execution. But two stories caught my eye last week for a more familiar picture of indiscipline and disarray. First, we learned from the Journal about the bizarre lengths to which the president's economic policy advisors went to get Mr. Trump to pause his destructive initial global tariff plan, how they had to ensure the tariff fan, Peter Navarro, was out of physical range of the president to get Mr. Trump to issue a statement revising the plan. Then there was the news of intensified internal fights at the Pentagon, as three aides to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth were ousted. They issued a joint statement that they had been victims of baseless attacks from colleagues. I don't doubt the seriousness of intent with which the Trump administration is seeking to remake the political and cultural landscape, nor do I disdain the fears of those who argue that the administration's expansive interpretations of executive authorities represents a threat to the constitutional order. The problem I have is that even they, as they overstep their limits, they seem to blunder deeper into the mire. Their biggest risk may be that voters will start to ask, what's the use of a strong man who can't do anything right? By Gerard Baker. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.